In 1990, State President F.W. de Klerk, the leader of the apartheid government in South Africa, decided that the dissident Nelson Mandela would be less of a threat out of prison than in the Robben Island jail cell that had been his home for more than 20 years.
I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. I am serious about bringing this matter to finality without delay.
Finality? Not quite. Like a genie of freedom and democracy, Nelson Mandela was out of the bottle, and South Africa and the world would never be the same. The genie turns 90. Happy birthday, Mr. Nelson Mandela. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 18th. Nelson Mandela, how do you say happy birthday to a man who sparked a revolution?
You sing it.
The American Human Development Report. It's all about the American dream. Also today, Barack Obama heads abroad. His itinerary is coming up. And eating out, as we know, is expensive unless you head to a Utah restaurant. There you pay what you can. Really, that and all the news. The New York Times is reporting today that faulty electrical work by private contractors on U.S. military bases in Iraq is more widespread than the Pentagon has previously acknowledged. Since the war began, 13 Americans have been electrocuted and more have been injured. The Times cites internal Army documents saying soldiers in one location were shocked almost daily. Homeland Security says terrorists are focusing on recruiting people with legitimate Western European passports and maybe using them as a way of slipping into the U.S. Here's Secretary Michael Chertoff.
I have a good degree of confidence we can catch people coming in. But I have to tell you, there's no guarantee, and they are working very hard to slip by us.
Chertoff's comments were warnings to the next administration.
Foreign ministers from all six countries involved in the North Korea nuclear talks will meet next week. It'll mark the first time talks are taking place at such a high level since they began 5 years ago. Vice President Al Gore is urging Americans to abandon fossil fuels and be carbon-free within a decade. He says doing so would make it easier to deal with other challenges, such as national security and a slowing economy.
The key is ending our dependence on carbon-based fuels. And if we grab hold of that thread and pull it, the other problems begin to unravel, and we've got the answer right in our hands.
The oil markets were apparently listening to Gore, at least for a while, down $15 a barrel over the last 2 days, but oil is climbing up again in Asia, more than $1.60 a barrel. The Dow gained nearly 2% yesterday, but is poised to open downward. What's the takeaway question this morning?
Mandela's 90th birthday. How do you honor a man who has inspired so many and sparked a revolution in his country?
And what would you tell a young person about the importance of Nelson Mandela as a global leader? We want to hear your stories, your advice, your memories and remembrances and honorifics of Nelson Mandela. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Also, that restaurant story is an interesting idea.
Pay as you go. Would you like to walk into a restaurant and say, I'd like some mashed potatoes and some chicken, and I'd like to pay $3. Is that okay?
And negotiations in restaurants. What do you think about that? Call us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin this morning with the Barack Obama campaign on the heels of raising more than $50 million in their latest fundraising effort and a major speech outlining Barack Obama's foreign policy. The candidate is no doubt packing his bags for a major foreign trip that is being treated by the American media, at least, with the significance of a state visit, not the foreign visit of a candidate, not even having spoken at his own party's convention yet. covering the Barack Obama campaign. And our friend is Jeff Zeleny, political correspondent for The New York Times. Jeff, I guess you get to spend some time in the swing state of Basra in the next couple of days, eh?
Exactly. It's no more Ohio, Missouri, and Virginia for at least a couple of days.
What do you
no
make?
No complaining here.
No complaining, right? What do you make of all the attention that Barack Obama is getting? John McCain just had a foreign trip that didn't attract as much attention, and you know, you've got three networks vying for exclusive interviews while he's overseas. This seems a little bit unprecedented.
Well, it does in many respects. The trip itself is somewhat unprecedented. You know, 4 years ago, certainly, and even 8 years ago, the candidates in both parties were not even thinking of traveling abroad during the middle of a campaign. You know, Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts was doing everything he could to not appear French, to not, you know, be viewed as foreign. But this time, with foreign policy such an important part of the presidential campaign, a key part of Senator Obama's strategy is showing to the audience here in America that he can be received well abroad, that he has the credentials to compete with John McCain. So he'll be there, but his important audience is here.
Yet there is enormous interest on the part of people in Europe and elsewhere to see Barack Obama up close and personal. Is there any sort of sensitivity on the part of the campaign that, you know, wild-eyed crowds of people in places like France and Iraq are going to send the message that Barack Obama is maybe more popular outside the U.S. than inside?
I mean, that's a major concern for the Obama campaign, which is one of the reasons his itinerary has been kept quite secret. And we're told that he's only probably going to be giving one major speech. It's probably going to be coming in Germany. But even that has created a bit of a stir in Berlin, because his advance people were looking for a place for his speech. One of the places that they thought looked good was the Brandenburg Gate. Well, that, of course, created some controversy last week. But the Obama campaign does not want throngs of people sort of adoring him all over the world, because they know what the McCain campaign and Republicans will do back in the U.S. They will say he is the president, you know, for them, not for us. But I think overall, Senator McCain
but
has
hold on there, Jeff.
Jeff,
hold on there for 1 second, because there is a flip side of that, which is looking at Obama overseas and having that image of someone who is composed and credible as a an American leader who can deal with foreign policy questions.
No, I think that's absolutely right, and that's one of the hurdles that he has in this campaign. But if there are images of him in every city of throngs of people, you know, sort of endorsing him or coming out to see him, we could see those replayed again in commercials, you know, back here. But I think everyone realizes that foreign policy is a big, you know, the most major issue other than the economy in this campaign.
Right.
Jeff, I think you won't fault him much for going over.
Right. Quickly then, on that precise point, are there any plans to meet with foreign leaders or with, you know, senior diplomats, any kind of high-profile one-on-ones set up, as far as we know?
Yes, absolutely. He'll be doing most all of his itinerary, we're told, is including meetings with the leaders in both in Israel, in Palestine, throughout the Palestinian leaders, you know, throughout Germany, France, and the UK. But it's beginning in with a trip to Iraq and Afghanistan. He'll be meeting with leaders throughout. This trip is going to be more closed door than public rallies. This is very much viewed as a substantive trip on their part. We'll see how the reaction from the crowd is.
All right, Jeff Zeleny, thanks so much, and you know, have a good trip.
We'll try.
Jeff Zeleny covers the Obama campaign for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Also in Washington, you know, you got to figure Ben Bernanke has his work cut out for him when he wakes up every morning and looks at the numbers. Markets way up, markets way down. Inflation at a pace to beat the rate of 26 years ago. Roger Lowenstein is the next in our series of people that we've been talking to this week about the importance of the Fed chairman and the people running economic policy in the United States at a moment when there appears to be a bit of a power vacuum in Washington, and at the same time that there's a bit of an economic crisis in America and the world. Roger Lowenstein, former Wall Street Journal reporter and the author of While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Roger, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Good morning.
It's a mouthful of a title, but anyway, you know, we got to have you back to talk about that book, because I'm intrigued. I feel like I've read half of the book already. Roger, Ben Bernanke is at a moment in Washington like no other that I've experienced in my political lifetime. Do you see him grabbing the reins of the U.S. economy and, to a certain extent, power in Washington in these weeks and months?
You know, one of the problems he faces is that people almost want him to grab the reins, or at least have the myth that a Fed chairman can grab the reins of the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy is up to 300 million people, and there's really a limit to, you know, what Ben Bernanke can do. If those 300 million people run out of credit to borrow, money to spend, if their business can't take on another employee or they have to lay someone off, he's got little tiny adjustments, like those little flaps on wings of an airplane that might make it, you know, turn a little more smoothly. But so his biggest issue, and I think his predecessor, Alan Greenspan, was a master, you know, at giving out the impression that he could grab the reins, and he's left Ben Bernanke in quite a predicament. Hmm.
Well, let's talk about the background of Ben Bernanke. He is an academic, Princeton professor, expert on the Depression of the 1930s, where many of those little wing flap levers were actually created to deal with the economic crisis of the 20th century. Do you think he has, any insights into what this crisis could possibly mean? And do we have any sense going forward what he might do?
That is the relevant, you know, part of his background. He has great insights into what he doesn't want this crisis to become. He doesn't want us to get into one of these downward spirals, sort of a black hole of economics where, you know, a bank fails and then we spend less money, and because we spend less money, you know, other people fail, and, you know, it just goes on and on, this black hole of the 1930s, and it was repeated in some sense in Japan in the 1990s when they couldn't get out of their credit crunch.
Right.
They really spent a whole decade without growth, and that background of Bernanke studying the Great Depression, and he came to believe that the Federal Reserve was largely to blame, is very much in his mind. And, you know, we see echoes of that now, with one bank after another reining in, with credit becoming less available. And
Roger, you make a really interesting point bringing up Japan there. Maybe the takeaway here regarding these early weeks of Bernanke dealing with this crisis, if you go back to Bear Stearns, is breaking the cycles, keeping one event from cycling into a series of bigger events. He's done things that kind of break the cycle. Now, broadly, the economy may be deteriorating, but he's prevented a chain reaction, it seems to me.
Well, we'll see. To some extent, the chain was already in motion. You know, the chain was in motion when all of these mortgages were issued, when all of these banks and financiers bought these complicated debt securities, CDOs and so forth, that were based on these mortgages. And as one mortgage after another fails and one security after another loses value, the chain keeps going. It's we're well beyond weeks. We're really... It's actually 1 year, believe it or not. We're speaking almost precisely the anniversary of when two hedge funds organized by Bear Stearns, stocked with mortgage securities, went belly up. And the things have really only been sliding downhill since then. And we should mention that the other side that Bernanke is dealing with is a very worrisome, incipient inflation.
Yeah. We're just beginning to deal with the inflation issue, and of course, based on the depression and his academic background, you know, using the Fed to deal with inflation is much more the kind of mainstream approach. Roger, we're going to leave it there this morning, but you know, this is a great, great seat to watch the economy looking at Ben Bernanke. Roger, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Roger's a former Wall Street Journal reporter and the author of While America Aged. The rest of the title you can go on our website and find. Thank you, Roger.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
866-869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today is Friday, July 18th, and it is also Nelson Mandela's birthday. He is, of course, one of the world's most inspirational giants, and his life is the story about South Africa's transformation.
The time for the healing of the wounds has come. We enter into a covenant that we shall build the society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall, a rainbow nation at peace with itself and the world.
That's Nelson Mandela on the day he took office as South Africa's first black president, and it was a long way from 1964 when Mandela was in court accused of plotting to overthrow the white minority-ruled apartheid government. At trial, he opened by saying democracy was an ideal that he was willing to die for. Joining us to talk about this remarkable man, a remarkable man himself, and one who knows Mandela very well, is Ahmed Kathrada, who was a prominent leader of the African National Congress, as well as Mandela's cellmate for more than two decades. Welcome, Mr. Kathrada.
Thank you very much, and good morning to the listeners. Thank you very much. I can hear you.
Very good, sir. And
can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir. And at the day of that trial back in 1964, could you have ever have imagined what Mandela and the ANC would accomplish?
Well, what I can say is that we were always optimistic that we will win one day. As to whether we thought that Mandela is going to be president or I'm going to be sitting with my colleagues in parliament, never thought of that. But we knew that the ANC was going to win one day. That optimism never left us.
You speak to Mandela regularly. What does he think about his 90th birthday?
Well, we are all, in fact, I'm on my way to his birthday, not today. I'll be there tomorrow. Today is his birthday, but we generally leave it to the family. Tomorrow there's going to be a bigger celebration, and I'll be going to that one.
Mr. Kathrada, thank you so very much. Seem to be having a bit of difficulty with that line there from South Africa.
Well, it's amazing to imagine Ahmed Kathrada, who is in the cell with in Robben Island with Nelson Mandela, trying to imagine what the future would be and what a future it became. Joining us now is Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times and author of Tree Shaker, the story of Nelson Mandela. Bill Keller, you witnessed firsthand during that campaign when Nelson Mandela became the president of South Africa, just the kind of change agent that this man was, casting a spell everywhere he went. How did it feel to be a witness to that?
Well, if you're a sucker for democracy, which I guess I am, it was exhilarating to watch. A little bit like Obama now, although those kinds of analogies are glib, he was a stadium rock star, and he would, his auto caravan would pull into some dusty township soccer stadium, and there would be people literally hanging from the tin roof over the grandstands and shouting and chanting and singing sort of liberation hymns, and the place would just erupt. He was, it was magical, on verging on scary. But what was, to me at least, equally interesting was the way he worked white audiences. Because, the dilemma that Mandela knew he had was that he could win the black vote in South Africa, the first free black vote, But the white minority had all the money. They had the army. They had the police. They had most of the guns and a variety of paramilitary organizations willing to use them. And he had to at least reassure the whites, both during the campaign and after, that they were not going to be driven into the sea or subject to all kinds of reprisals. And he did that masterfully, too.
You know, Adora and I were talking about this earlier, and I suspect Adora has a question as well, but how did he manage to do that reassurance and maintain his authenticity to all parties?
Well, that was the amazing balancing act. I mean, one-word summary of Nelson Mandela is politician, and it's not a word that tends to glow with glory these days. But he had the ability on the one hand to bring along his own constituencies, who were often fractious. He had a lot of people behind him who really wanted to drive the whites into the sea and confiscate their lands. But on the other hand, to reach out quite effectively to the adversary. There's a really interesting, I suppose I should be using the moment to plug my own book, but there's a really interesting book coming out in September by an English writer named John Carlin about what he sees as the sort of singular event in the reconciliation of the races in South Africa. And it's quite a wonderful book. And that event, oddly enough, is the 1995 World Cup Rugby Championship in South Africa. Rugby was always the sport of the Afrikaners, the white oppressor. Blacks played soccer. They had no interest whatsoever. In fact, they loathed rugby. And mm-hmm. Mandela managed to reach out to the whites by embracing their sport and, amazingly, bringing along
that was amazing
a lot of blacks as fans.
And Bill Keller, we're going to ask you to stick with us for a few minutes so that we can talk more about Mandela and his ability to bridge those gaps. So we're going to ask you to hold on for a moment while we get some of the latest headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Reporters say that some private contractors' electrical work on Iraqi military bases is unsafe. That report comes from the New York Times. The war crimes trial of Osama bin Laden's former driver will begin on Monday. And Australia's Qantas Airways says it's slashing 1,500 jobs around the world as it tries to deal with high fuel costs. Now, of course, there are many celebrations around South Africa and around the world because of the birthday of Nelson Mandela. Some of the most touching are from the youngsters. That's kiddies from Nigeria, Uganda and Malawi paying tribute to Nelson Mandela, who is 90 today. And one of the most remarkable tributes, also from a fellow South African, it was the president under white minority rule. That's F.W. de Klerk. He gave a very touching tribute to his former nemesis.
He was born to be a leader. He was trained to become the principal advisor of the paramount chief of his people. He has the assurance, the humility, and the grace of a true natural aristocrat.
That was former South African President F.W. de Klerk.
De Klerk and Mandela share a Nobel Prize.
They did indeed.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 18th, and we are celebrating Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday. And to talk about his legacy and how he created it is the executive editor of the New York Times. That's Bill Keller. He's also the author of Tree Shaker, The Story of Nelson Mandela. And welcome back, Bill. You were talking about Nelson Mandela's ability to bridge the gap between black South Africans who had been so oppressed under the apartheid system and white South Africa. And I really want you to tell us about your trip during Mandela's campaign to be the first black South African president. You went to Robben Island with Mandela, and you say it was really more than a photo op.
Yeah, well, it certainly was one of those campaign photo ops. I mean, you know, but Mandela went back with half a dozen of his fellow prisoners from Robben Island. And it was, you know, even the jaded journalists who tagged along with him on that trip pretty quickly got unjaded. You know, he toured us around, took us to his cell, took us out to the stone quarry where for much of the time that he was there, the forced labor was to march out to the quarry and make gravel, basically. And the interesting thing was it was still a prison, no longer for political prisoners, but for ordinary criminals at that time. Now it's a museum, a park. But the it was still had a white Afrikaner chief warden, and he greeted Mandela like a celebrity. Everybody was kind of falling all over themselves to honor this returning hero. You know, he was utterly gracious about it. He did not sort of seize the moment to talk about the miseries that he suffered, although reporters kind of pushed him, you know, to talk about how awful it was in prison. You know, he's just not by nature a whiner. He used the opportunity to talk about reconciliation.
You know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was an innovation that Nelson Mandela, with others in South Africa, brought to the world, and it's been replicated in other conflict zones. What do you think, for young people, the message is for, you know, the significance of Nelson Mandela? Is he a figure that exists in time, or are there elements of his legacy that can be translated into politicians of our time?
Oh, I absolutely think that there are lessons to be learned from his life. As I said before, it's glib to try and make analogies between, you know, historical periods and historical figures. But, you know, the amazing thing about Mandela was, and it's rare among people who are sort of moral authorities and, you know, martyrs and dissidents behind sort of revolutionary causes, was his ability to sort of bury his bitterness and his anger and just kind of get the job done. He was, I think Rick Stengel, who was the ghostwriter of Mandela's autobiography, described him as the most pragmatic of idealists. And that pragmatism served him and served his country extremely well. I mean, when I got to South Africa, which was in 92, they were negotiating the framework for a new constitution. They were still 2 years away from the first free election. And it was clear that apartheid was over, but it was not at all clear that this was going to happen peacefully, that there wasn't going to be a bloodbath. And the fact that there wasn't a bloodbath is because Mandela managed to navigate that path, you know, down the middle and keep both sides feeling they had a vested interest.
Bill, I can't resist asking about your personal connection here, because you went in a period of just a few years from the likes of Boris Yeltsin and Gorbachev to South Africa and Nelson Mandela. I mean, my God, what a view of global change, and yet it's Mandela who's the one who sticks with you.
Well, Gorbachev and Yeltsin stick with me a fair amount, too, but if I had to pick one of them to hold up as a role model for my kids, or for that matter, for our current crop of politicians, I think Mandela would be the one. There is a kind of calm and steadiness of purpose about him. I don't mean to. It's very easy to get reverential about somebody like Mandela. And
well, you did say you were a sucker for democracy.
I am a sucker for democracy. I mean, you have to. You know, Mandela was a human being. He was a pretty lousy husband and father. He was opportunistic about his friends and allies. And about the tactics that were employed in the cause. He condoned stuff that today we would certainly call terrorism. You know, he was not a saint, but he was an unbelievably talented strategist and tactician who kept his eye on the prize. And the prize was, you know, a peaceful, democratic South Africa. South Africa's not perfect either these days, but it's, you know, it's in the hands of South Africans.
Well worth remembering. on this the birthday of Nelson Mandela. Bill Keller, thank you very much. Executive editor of the New York Times and author of Tree Shaker, The Story of Nelson Mandela.
Thank you.
Headlines time from Femi Okeh, because she's just joined us.
Hello there. It is just coming up to 21 minutes to the hour. Problems with electrical wiring at a U.S. military base in Iraq, and many military bases in Iraq, is worse than the Pentagon first actually said. 13 people on bases have been electrocuted since 2003, and the New York Times reports many more have been injured. Former President Bill Clinton has unveiled a deal with six Chinese and Indian companies to cut malaria drug prices by one-third. A CDC study says that Mississippi has the highest obesity rate in the nation, with a third of adults who are overweight. Also in the top three, Tennessee and Alabama. A drug once used to treat hay fever may significantly improve symptoms in patients with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. And Greg Norman takes the lead in the British Open this morning. Rocco Mediate is off pace after his three-way lead going into today. And out right now, this very second, we could leave the studio and go and see The Dark Knight.
Oh.
At 1 minute past midnight, it started showing. The Dark Knight is the latest in the Batman series. And, of course, it has the very last appearance of Heath Ledger, who plays the Joker. And I do believe we've got a little excerpt from the movie.
A year ago, these cops and lawyers wouldn't dare cross any of you. I mean, what happened?
If you want to hear more, you have to go and spend, what is it, around here, $12 to see a movie?
Well, but this movie is shaping up to be like the biggest movie of the year. They added showings here in New York at 3 o'clock and 6 a.m.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
I'm sure those lines were long. Mm. I have no doubt.
And I think because this is Heath Ledger's very last film, and he looks absolutely spectacular in the movie.
Well, the reviews have been really good.
And the premiere the other night, his parents flew over from Australia to go to the premiere. So there's a lot of buzz about this movie. I think it's going to be really the big deal coming up for the weekend and probably for the rest of the summertime as well.
Yeah, it's like Batman gets upstaged by the Joker. And it's a posthumous performance. Mm. It's unbelievable. Thanks, Femi.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Are you going to go see it?
I am. Yeah. I'm going to be one of those people in the lines. I like the first movie. I like Heath Ledger. Why
not? Christian Bale's?
It's a good weekend event. Do I like who?
Christian Bale's.
Yes, and him too. What about you guys? You're going to hit the movie theater this weekend?
After I go to bed.
Yes.
Sleep a bit. Wake up on Sunday. Then I'll go see the movie.
I'll catch it on DVD.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. As we've been talking about, today is Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday. The South African leader, the icon, the worldwide man of inspiration turns 90. And as we celebrate his birthday, it's an unlikely story, Mandela, a boy from a South African village who became a man unabashedly questioning peaceful means for taking down the ruling white minority. Here's a 1961 BBC interview.
There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and nonviolence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider, in the light of our experiences, whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
Nelson Mandela became defined by those methods. He would become the leader of the armed wing of the African National Congress, a role that would turn him into a wanted man. In 1962, he was arrested, reportedly after America's CIA tipped off South African security police. His 1964 trial riveted the nation. His testimony, defiant to South African authorities to the end, about his devotion to freedom.
It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
Mandela, in fact, narrowly missed being hanged. Instead, he was sentenced to life in prison at the country's notorious Robben Island. And over the decade, though, people of the world did not forget about him, and the crowd's cries grew louder for his release. His body abused, but his mind is still free. Are you so blind that you cannot see?
Calls to free Nelson Mandela were really a theme of the 1980s, along with confrontation with the apartheid government. And on February 11, 1990, tens of thousands of delirious and inspired and grateful black Africans greeted Nelson Mandela after he walked out of prison after 27 years.
Friends, comrades, I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy, and freedom for all.
That was Nelson Mandela at 75 years old.
Political career beginning.
Just beginning. And he was saying the same things then that he'd said going into prison. And within 4 years, he was elected by black South Africans to become, as well as white South Africans, but it was the first time black South Africans could vote. And he became South Africa's first black president. His honors worldwide are just too many to mention. But here in the U.S., buildings are named after him, books have been written, and musicians have immortalized him. Look, my squad half man, trip half man, teller. We rap by what we see, meaning reality. From people busting caps to like Mandela being free. Why Mandela did all them years, all that blood, all that sweat, and all them tears. And I can name thousands more that died in the struggle from Mr. Wallace to Mr. Shakur. That's a collection of songs by The Roots, A Tribe Called Quest, and Styles P.
A world icon, Mandela turns 90 today, and the voices are weighing in on World Have Your Say, the BBC program. Nelson Mandela is on a mountain compared to all current heads of state I'm aware of. Africa desperately needs another young man to step up with the same strength and compassion. And happy birthday, Nelson Mandela.
He'll be with his family today, celebrating a quiet day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Time for the latest headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Hi there. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the hour. The Swiss bank UBS has stopped all offshore banking for U.S. customers after accusations of helping clients dodge taxes. Senegal's president says that George Bush told him the U.S. might send troops to Darfur if African leaders don't end the tragedy in Sudan. Topping the record number of theaters, the Batman movie, The Dark Knight, is expected to pass the 100 million mark, and that's opening this weekend. And Iran's foreign minister is saying that he expects progress at forthcoming nuclear talks in Geneva. The U.S. is sending their Undersecretary of State, William Burns, to the talks. The talks start this weekend. That's a quick wrap of the headlines from this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention, though. I was actually looking at a book that's absolutely fascinating here. It's called The Measure of America. It's something like liner notes for the American political campaign right now, and it's based on the premise of measuring country-to-country comparisons that the United Nations does, called the Human Development Index. It's a way of creating comparisons country-to-country that allow the United Nations to better track development and deficiencies and competition between nations. But three authors decided that this was a good strategy for actually taking a look at the United States, and so Sarah Bird Sharps and two co-authors came up with The Measure of America, the American Human Development Report. And Sarah Bird Sharps joins us from Washington, D.C. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
You know, what does this Human Development Index bring to our understanding of America as you started to take a look at the United States using these UN-based criteria?
Basically, we are measuring three things that Americans care deeply about, health, education, and income. And it's quite a simple index. using the life expectancy, we measure health, you know, everybody's ability to live a long and healthy life. For education, we're just measuring your degree attainment as well as enrollment. And for income, we're simply measuring median earnings, the earnings you get from your labor. And the point of doing this is to try to bring sort of some more nonpartisan, balanced discussion to the debate going on right now about these critical issues in the U.S.
And you break it down by congressional district as well as state, and you can make some very, very interesting comparisons, even from subway stop to subway stop here in New York. Tell us about some of the interesting comparative facts that sort of came out as you began to look at this.
Sure. In the index, we ranked every state in the U.S. from 1 to 50, every congressional district from 1 to 436, and we also ranked the major ethnic groups in the U.S. And I can give you some findings that I think really surprised us and that we hope will generate some debate about why things are so uneven. There's a district in Colorado where about just under 5% of adults don't have a high school diploma or equivalency. On the other hand, there's a district in urban Houston, Texas, where nearly half of the people, adults, don't have have dropped out of high school and have no equivalency.
Wow.
That rate is about what the U.S. had on average a half a century ago.
I mean, one of the conclusions from reading this book is that the United States really should not be quite so self-satisfied about its progress in the raw measures, you know, economy per capita income, that ostensibly put us on the top of the heap. In many measures, we're actually not at all.
Yeah, we have a tendency, I think, to rely too heavily on economic indicators. How are we doing on consumption, on inflation, on employment, et cetera? Those are important, but they don't give you the full picture of how people are faring. And if you look, for instance, at, you know, Asian Americans have a lifespan of about an average of about 86 years. On the other hand, African Americans have a lifespan of about 73 years. That's where the country was on average in the late 1970s. So what we're trying to say is, yeah, it's important to measure, you know, consumer price index, inflation, things that we measure every hour. But we actually measure things, for instance, like infant mortality rate every 10 years.
What do you hope candidates would do, John McCain, Barack Obama, with this information as we get into the presidential debate between now and November?
We're hoping that they'll use this to focus a bit more on how people are doing in the country, about which groups are falling behind or stalled, which groups are surging ahead, and why. We're also hoping that they'll realize, and you know, one of the things that we talk about in the report is how in the past we've had bold leadership on policies such as the GI Bill or Medicare or Social Security that have significantly reduced helped the people who are falling behind, reduced poverty in this country, et cetera. And we're hoping that bold leadership, again, will address some of the challenges we face. And one of them we talk a lot about is health care. We spend about $230 million every hour on healthcare in the United States, and yet we have less long lifespans than all Western European countries and virtually every Scandinavian country.
And in this book, you can discover 78% of American citizens are uninsured, 71% work full-time. That's a terrible disparity. Sarah Bird Sharps, thanks so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me.
You know, I think of this book, The Measure of America, as kind of the liner notes for the election, broken down by congressional district and state. The Human Development Index is applied to the United States. Adora?
John, we're going to talk food now. Denise, Soretta, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Now, you're in Salt Lake City, right?
Right.
And you run a restaurant. What's the special you're cooking up today?
The cooks create different food every day without a menu, so they actually aren't even here yet. But you, we'll have quiche, we'll have a hot soup and a cold soup.
Okay,
we'll
say a quiche. I'd like a slice of quiche. How much is that going to cost me?
You price your own quiche, and you actually get to choose your own portion.
Okay, but let's say I get to the register, and I find that I don't have any money in my wallet, and my credit card is declined. What happens then?
Well, there is no register. There's an honor drop treasure box with a slot in it. So
a what?
just a treasure box. A couple of things could happen. You run your own debit or credit card at our place, so you could actually put a failed transaction slip in there, or you can say, hey, Denise, I don't know what's going on. I'll catch you tomorrow or the next time I'm in, which would be fine.
Are you for real?
We are for real, 5 years, and sustainable and profitable.
How do people react when they come in and there's no prices attached to their meatloaf or their chicken or their quiche?
I actually love it. The first time might be a little bit like you, Adore. Is that, are you guys for real? What? But after that, they're right at home. They love the opportunity to choose their own portion, not have to overeat, waste food, and to have everything on the honor system.
So give me like an example.
Of
someone ordering a meal, like what do they order and then what do they pay? And if they can't pay, are they in your kitchen washing dishes?
Right, all of the above. Actually, when you walk in, you're in our kitchen, and it's an open kitchen, and we're very similar to a buffet, so you see all the dishes, but we serve you the exact portion. So people have options. Yes, they could take their meal at the end of the meal before they leave. They walk out. They can pay a fair donation, and that's on the honor system. Or you can volunteer. Every hour you get a voucher for a meal. Any children you're responsible for can eat with you on that voucher. And we also have a complimentary staples dish daily, like dal and rice, and people can eat that, especially if they have no time or money.
This just sounds all too good to be true, especially given the fact that in the last year food prices have increased nearly 15%, making it expensive for everyone. But if you're running a restaurant, how do you make any money if you're letting people pay as they can?
Well, we ask people to pay a fair amount on the amount of food that they took, and that's relative, again, to what they're used to paying, to their income, but it's also based on restaurant prices. So there is a profit margin built into that.
Okay. Denise? Oopsie, yeah. I guess they just cut me off there. Denise?
Yes.
Saretta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
from
you.
Salt Lake City, where she owns One World Cafe, and you can pay what you can for a meal there.
I'd be scared to be the chef in that restaurant because, I mean, what if people were coming in saying, you know, this quiche is only like 50 cents. This is a 50 cent quiche.
She says it works, though. Yeah. But I guess people are honest, or more honest than maybe some of us cynics might suspect.
All right, well, we are celebrating all day. How do you honor Nelson Mandela, who turns 90 today? We're going to play your ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's the takeaway for this hour.
No more Ohio, Missouri, and Virginia for at least a couple days.
That's our friend Jeff Zeleny from the New York Times.
On his way to the swing state of Basra as he accompanies Barack Obama on his foreign trip that's coming up. It's time for a Friday check on the Veep Stakes. What's going on, Adora?
Well, our presidential running mate stock trading game, that's what it is on Facebook. And we have yet another week. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is your top pick for McCain, and Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius is still the top pick for Obama's vice presidential slot.
Is it conceivable there will be two female running mates? That would be another historical element in this campaign.
But that's what the people want, and we've had hundreds participating. So why don't you log on to our website, and you'll find a link to the Veep Stakes, and you can trade them.
If you missed anything in today's program, you can catch up with us on iTunes and Friend Feed, or sign up for our weekly email newsletter.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's a takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.